Hey everyone, welcome to the Science Bloggers podcast. I'm David Latchman, the host of this show, and I hope you're all doing well during the coronavirus pandemic and are staying safe, sane, and healthy. We're all in this together during this period in human history. This episode's guest is Kevin McAvoy, an aquarium biologist. Kevin also happens to be one of the hosts of the Radioactive Spider Pod, a comedy podcast about the 1990s animated Spider-Man series. Kevin and I talk about his work and what is involved in managing and maintaining some of the exhibits you typically experience when you visit an aquarium. We'll also discuss the important role science communication plays in engaging with the public and helping them become more knowledgeable and engage with the world around them. So, hello, Kevin. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Yourself?
I'm great. So thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
And why don't we start? Why don't you tell the listeners a little something about yourself?
Sure. My name is Kevin McAvoy. I'm a senior aquarium biologist with a major public aquarium. And I'm also a head writer and co-host of Radioactive Spider Pod, which is about a 90s Spider-Man cartoon. Not super related, but, you know, it's true. So I've been in the aquarium industry for a number of years now, and I do a lot of work with exhibits.
Okay. So what exactly is an aquarium biologist?
Sure. So obviously, there's a large number of people that work in an aquarium and a lot of different factors. Within the husbandry department, we have what are called aquarists or aquarium biologists, and they're the ones actually taking care of the animals. But it's kind of a larger job than that, not just, you know, feeding the animals and kind of checking up on their general health, but also the health and well-being of the exhibits. Basically, each aquarium individual system is its own little ecosystem, and there's a lot that goes into that, and keeping it healthy for all the animals that live in it. It's a big job, so it's kind of a specialized version of a marine or freshwater biologist.
Oh, I see. So what does it take to build an ecosystem like that for people to see?
quite a bit. And it really depends on the size and scale that you're talking about. I mean, anybody can have their own home aquarium. And in a lot of ways, what you do in a public aquarium is a massive version of that. But when you start looking at the scale that you look at, for example, one of the exhibits could be, you know, 1.8 million liters of water instead of, you know, a couple dozen that you might have in a home tank. You start looking at a lot of issues in terms of flow, in terms of just, you know, doing a water change. All this stuff changes dramatically when you look at that level of scale. And also the animals become a lot more complex. It's not just goldfish. So you're looking at elasmobranchs like sharks and rays. There's all kinds of stuff. So when you start something fresh and new, there's a whole process that goes into it. But it's basically trying to replicate the natural world. And that means not just in terms of decor and the animals and the water chemistry, but even things like making sure that the bacterial biome that exists in the tank is ready to go so that natural cycles like the nitrogen cycle that would happen in the wild are occurring in the tank. So you are, in a sense, building an ecosystem.
Wow, that sounds like a lot of work. So typically, how many people work on a project like this to keep an ecosystem alive and healthy?
Again, depends on scale. If it's a smaller aquarium, they might have a much smaller staff of only a few people. A larger aquarium could have like dozens of people, like we do. Something very large, like say Georgia Aquarium, like they have an open ocean tank, for example. That's the one with whale sharks in it, famously the one located in Atlanta. And they have a team of, I believe, almost 10 people who work explicitly on that one exhibit. It is a monstrously huge exhibit, but one single tank has, 10 people working on it.
Wow, that sounds like it's like a massive undertaking. So,
yeah,
you know, I imagine to maintain an aquarium, you know, of any size takes a lot of water. So how do you source that, and what is the impact on the environment?
Well, it really depends on where the aquarium in question is located. Ones that are located near the coast, say Monterey Aquarium or Monterey Bay or things like that, will often use like a flow through system wherein they'll take in water from, you know, the actual environment. They'll usually put it through a cleaning process, although some smaller aquariums might not, might just be live seawater. But they'll usually do a basic filtration, and then it'll go into the tanks. And then when it's out, it gets dumped out back into the ocean, which, you know, it's just sort of a cyclical kind of thing. For other aquariums that are not located, you know, next to a suitable body of water like that, anything inland, for example, you can't exactly be piping seawater that kind of a distance. So you have to make it yourself, which is a massive undertaking as well. Some people will use pre-made mixes, which are basically giant versions of what some at-home aquariums will use. And that will have all the constituent elements from seawater. Others, like the institution that I work for, we actually make our own formula. So we have the individual salts that we're adding, which is, you know, over a dozen of them. And you're trying to very finely tune your seawater to exactly what your animals need. So that can be a lot of work as well. It could take, you know, teams of you know, three people moving 6,000 pounds of salt to produce 35,000 gallon batches or something like that. And you'll run through that in about a week.
Wow. I didn't know it was possible that, you know, you can make your own seawater, you know, so that's something that's completely new to me.
Yeah. On one hand, it's more work, but on the other hand, you can control everything about it. Whereas, you know, if you're pulling from the actual ocean, there could be variations that, you know, just happening on a day to day. If there's a heavy rain, for example, you're going to get a lot more dilute water. Usually they would pull from a deeper part of the, you know, the water next to them. You know, if you go down a little bit and a little ways out, you're going to get water that's pretty much consistent, but, there can be regional and seasonal fluctuations in the water, whereas you can be very specific when you make your own water. So there's advantages to both.
Yeah, I can imagine. So what exactly does it take to become an aquarium biologist? You know, what do you need to specialize in?
Yeah, we've got a number of different people who come from different backgrounds. Generally speaking, it's going to involve an undergraduate degree in biology, typically animal biology, marine biology, freshwater biology. I came from a zoology background. I like biology, but I wasn't big into plants, so that was my deciding factor. And some people may even have master's degrees within that field as well. My additional degree is actually in science communication, which is why I volunteered to be on this podcast. But it gets fairly multidisciplinary. Usually there's some intangibles that we're also looking for. Scuba diving, for example, is a big part of the job. So having your dive ticket is an important additional thing to have.
And I imagine like science communication is also a big part of the job. So how exactly does that play into, you know, working for an aquarium?
Yeah, it is. It's a very multidisciplinary job. You wear a lot of hats. Like one day, I mean, there's the everyday stuff where you're taking care of your animals, you're looking into them, you're looking after their health, you're working on their nutrition. But then you might also be building those like systems or servicing the life support elements, which is a little little more technical. And then you also have chances to interact with the public. Like we'll do, the aquarist team will speak to the public. We'll have they have separate shows and stuff like that where the education team takes the lead. But there's also instances where people will get a chance to talk to the people who actually take care of the animals. So you'll have to get out there on the floor and speak to people and, you know, talk about how you're feeding them and their biology and things like that. I've been in the field for a while now and I've had a lot of chances to do some other fun stuff as well. I've done television, like children's shows and Shark Week and things like that. Also doing some talks for the public and stuff like that as well. So you get a chance to talk to people. And for me specifically, I work within a certain area of the aquarium that is a changeable exhibit space, which just to be clear for anyone who isn't familiar, most zoos, aquarium, and science centers will have areas that are designated to change regularly. So maybe every year to 2 years, that area will be kind of ripped out and something new comes in. And that lets you try new things, but it's also very useful for marketing and getting people to come back. It's like, oh, you haven't been in here in a year. Well, we have this new cool thing for you to see. So that's my area. And so basically getting to design a new exhibit space every 2 years or so. So that's actually building these exhibits is a major public interaction. You have to think about a lot of things there.
So going from one exhibit and changing it into another, I guess like one, you have to move all this water, but you also have to move all these animals to a new location or to a new exhibit. How do you ensure that the stress to these animals are minimized?
Well, animal transports, it's a major thing, not just for doing a new exhibit space, but, you know, just older exhibits or as, you know, biology continues and animals grow up and then pass away or new animals are born, you're going to have fluctuating levels in the population. And so you're going to have to move animals around from time to time. And so there's no blanket answer. And that's something I think I'm going to have to say a lot. There's no blanket answer because animals are so specific. And what works for one animal can maybe not work for another. Like, for example, if it's a small fish, let's say, you know, I don't know, a rock bass or something like that from a freshwater exhibit, it'd be a fairly simple matter of being able to catch that animal up and then move it over in a small body of water. You could either a bag or a cooler or something like that. When you're talking about something very large, like, say, a large grouper or an elasmobranch, like a shark or a ray or something like that, then you're talking about a completely different set of circumstances and probably a lot more hardware because their demands are just so much different.
So as far as science communication goes, it's like, do you have any personal philosophy or insight into how that aquarium science can be communicated or should be communicated to the public?
Sure. While I was doing my second degree in science communication, there was a very heavy emphasis put on utilizing constructivist versus didactic methods of teaching and learning, which in a nutshell, didactic is like the classic teacher talking, kids taking notes sort of thing. It's lectures, it's educational films, it's podcasts, and it can work for a lot of people. But in zoos and aquaria as well, it could be like an animal and then you just have its name and then a fun fact, it's just a picture. That's what it is. But constructivist teaching is the idea that we construct our own understanding of a subject. And so you should optimize learning around that. And it's a good ideal. And it's also like, you know, maybe doing a science experiment in a classroom instead of just reading about it or observing a live animal in a zoo and aquarium or like using simulations and stuff like that. It incorporates like learning choice and social interaction. You can kind of talk to the people around you. You build your understanding. So it's constructivist. So that's sort of what I was taught with. And if nothing else, I'm a very practical person, so I see the time and place for both types of learning. Sometimes you just have to have things told to you, and sometimes it's good to explore. It does seem to be true that knowledge sticks to you better when you discover it, and I think that's something that zoo and aquaria and science centers have a very good chance of doing, and you're already ahead of the game in terms of helping people learn because you're go to an aquarium or you go to a zoo and you're immersed in a new experience and you have that learning choice where you kind of just set your own schedule. Nobody says, hey, you've got to go look at, you know, the elephants now, or you got to go look at the shark right now. Like, you can stand there as long as you want. And observe whatever you want. So people are already doing that. And so it's a good chance to sort of enable that. You want to have the facts there. You want to have the information there for those people who want it. And so that people get a clear picture. But if you can kind of go towards that ideal, allow people to have this experience where they learn sort of organically, that is the ideal for me. So when we're making a new exhibit, Variety is always something that you want to look towards. So the people come in here, they're trying new things, they're getting their hands on whenever they can, even if it's not, you know, touching an animal or anything like that, but it's, manipulating objects in order to learn, looking at animals from different angles, not just a flat plane of glass or something, but being able to walk around it, or, tunnels that can go through tanks and stuff like that, where people get a different look at animals. It's a really good thing, and it sticks with people, and that's what it's all about, is trying to educate the public.
Yeah. So the animals in your exhibits, are they like local, or do they come from other parts of the world?
It's a combination. Obviously, there's advantages to both. So you want to try and tie in your local element, because it's going to help people sort of identify with something. It's very cool to see weird and wondrous stuff that you wouldn't be able to see anywhere else. Like, that is part of the reason that these institutions exist, because frankly, not everybody can afford to get on a plane and go to, you know, Australia and try and go around in a swamp and look for this animal. Nor would it be practical. So to be able to bring these things out and actually make them accessible is something really good. On the other hand, you also want to have that local thing so that, you know, they kind of realize, oh, this is something from my own backyard. It's something I can care about, and it's something that I can act on, because just teaching people about these animals is only step one. Step two is trying to get some action out of it, in a positive change. And so whether that's getting them to, you know, care a little bit more about, you know, the levels of pollution in their local streams, because it's affecting this cute little red-side dace or something like that. And or whether it's, you know, making sure that they're making proper seafood choices when they go out to dinner, whatever it is, you need that kind of local and kind of bizarre element in order to really draw people in, I think.
Yeah, and I've talked to quite a few wildlife biologists who also say the same thing, that, you know, the best way to get people involved and interested in the environment is to show them the creatures that live around them locally. And that's one of the best ways to get them to care, you know, especially when you start talking about things like how, you know, what we do impacts the environment. When you talk about climate change, once we can see how it impacts us locally, we become much more socially active to do things.
Yeah. No, it's very true. It's really interesting to see that, you know, people come away with those messages and what tends to stick. And it is that local element a lot of times. It's, I didn't even know this animal existed, and, you know, my choices are impacting its environment. Well, okay, maybe I need to do things a little bit differently. And whether that's changing your behaviors or changing your choices and making purchases, because a lot of times it's not just what you're doing, it's the companies or corporations that you're supporting with your money and the way they are conducting business that affects these animals. So it's always a little more complex, and that complexity is hard to sometimes get across, but it's great to see when you're able to make those connections.
So for people that may not have the chance to visit an aquarium, or because they're not close to one, how do you suggest that they become more knowledgeable about, you know, aquarium life, well, sea life?
I mean, there's no real substitution for getting to see animals in person, and that's sort of the mission of a lot of these places. But it's always worth checking out just around these institutions. I know a lot of them will have things like vans, tours that they'll do, whether it's a zoo or an aquarium or what have you, and they'll be able to kind of go on the road. It's a pretty common thing, actually, where they'll go to outlying communities that may not have access to these things normally, and be able to, you know, do public spaces and schools and stuff, and bring animals to the people. It won't be nearly the same thing. It's not going to be a big old shark stuck in the back of a minivan or something, but it is, you'll get a good sense of things. And so that's always an opportunity as well. I mean, if you have the chance to sort of just go out and be on a you know, around the bodies of water, you're going to get these experiences as well. And it doesn't have to be, you know, the Pacific Ocean or Fiji in the middle of nowhere or something like that. It can be local ponds, streams, marshes, that sort of stuff. Going out into the environment is going to start to give you these interactions.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That makes sense. So let's talk about the reactive spider pond, you know, a little bit. You also talk about is it 1980s TV show?
Yeah, it's I talk about the one from the 1990s. Yeah, that's the one I grew up on as a kid. So
how did that start? How does an aquarium biologist start doing something like that?
Alcohol mostly. The show is done by myself, my wife, and a good friend of ours. And you know, a few years ago, we were we were talking about the show, just reminiscing nostalgia styles, in a bar, and we decided that we would kind of give this thing a shot. And so we're now, I think, 40 episodes deep, and it's been going well. I don't know what'll happen when we eventually finish the show, but for now, it's a lot of fun. You know, we kind of go back, kind of look at it, and when you look at the stuff with a lens, you know, it shaped you. It's not always how the way exactly the way you remember it, which is always funny for us. But we're all very nerdy. We're all very scientifically minded. So. You know, we kind of look at it in a very analytical way. Like I'm a marine biologist. My wife is a PhD in microbiology, and and the other co-host, Peter, is a computer scientist. So, it's very science minded watching a character that's very science minded. So, I think that plays a big part of it, is kind of the frustration that you'll have at like, that is not how that works. That does not make any sense, but you know, it's still a kid's show. So we're having fun.
Yeah, I remember watching it when I was a kid, and you know, Spider-Man was also, you know, sort of instrumental in getting me interested in science. So, you know, it's always a fun character to watch, you know, especially now he's part of the MCU for a while. I don't know how much longer. Yeah. So, you know,
I'm sure he'll stay around. The money's there. It's all about the money, right?
Yeah, the money is there, so hopefully there'll be incentive to stay around.
Yep.
So as we wrap up, are there any final things you want to say or talk about?
Yeah, I think the big thing that I wanted to say was I think that at the end of the day, when you if you can get out and experience this stuff through a local aquarium or zoo, specifically an accredited aquarium and zoo. I want to say that there is a big difference there between the sort of the roadside zoos that you can find, you know, dotting the landscape in some places where the regulations are a little bit more lax, and the larger public institutions. And that's something worth looking into before you visit pretty much any of these, is to make sure that this is a place that is accredited, whether it's AZA or other some other governing body, to make sure that, you know, the animals that you're going to see are being taken care of, that they are given the highest standard of care, because there are a number of not quite as legitimate institutions that kind of give a bad name, I think. You know, I've talked to a lot of people and thought a lot about the role of animals in captivity. And so I think making sure that it's an appropriate institution is key.
Well, thank you for being here. You know, I really do appreciate it.
Oh, well, my pleasure.
And I look forward to doing this again if the opportunity presents itself.
Sure. That'd be great. Maybe even get one of my co-hosts in here who, my wife is probably the much more impressive person when it comes to science. So maybe that would be the next opportunity.
So what type of microbiology does she do?
Primarily, she works on Well, you know, as she continued through her career, it's becoming harder and harder for me to understand the minutia. But it's basically works on bacterial cell proteins, specifically the surface proteins, carrier proteins and stuff like that, as well as bacterial interaction. Viral bacterial interactions.
Maybe I'll see. I'll find a way to bring her on as well on the show.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
So thank you for doing this.
Yeah, no problem.
And thank you for being here.
Yeah, my pleasure. All right.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed or learned something from this episode, please leave a comment or rating on whatever platform you listened on and share or tell others about this episode. Every little bit helps in getting the word out. We also have a Patreon account, so any amount you can contribute will help. So check it out if you can. I hope everyone stays safe and healthy, and that you join us for the next episode of the Science Bloggers Podcast.